Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with my now customary co-host, Harriet Hageman. We're gonna have to stop saying with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione if John's in trial much longer. But I guess the good news is that he's not on trial. He's just helping conduct the trial. So, Harriet, welcome back to Administrative Static, and you have a very interesting item to kick us off with today. So let me turn it over to you.
Yes, Mark, thank you. It's wonderful to be with you again. I'm glad to be back on Administrative Static, and I'm looking forward to when John's able to return to the office and we can learn all about the trial that he has been conducting for the last almost month, which is a terribly long trial. Today, we're going to be talking about a situation or several situations, actually, from the Western United States. The first one I'm going to discuss is the fact that we're coming upon an anniversary of a terrible environmental catastrophe that occurred in Colorado. And it was on August 5th, 2015, that EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, through a contractor that it had hired, along with the Colorado Division of Reclamation, Mining, and Safety, used an excavator to dig out away tons of rock and debris that were in front of the portal of the Gold King Mine. I'm sure that many of our listeners will remember this particular circumstance and what happened thereafter. By breaching the collapsed portal of the Gold King Mine, the EPA, keep in mind, is the federal agency that is specifically tasked with protecting our environment. But in this particular case, they themselves are the ones that created the environmental catastrophe. When they breached that mine, they released toxic sludge of over 3 million gallons of acid mine drainage and over 880,000 pounds of heavy metals into the Animas River watershed down in San Juan County. The water, many people will remember the photographs and the videos. It was described as the Yellow River seen around the world. Some people said it was the Orange River seen around the world, but the photographs were just really pretty frightening. One of the things that always bothered me about that.
It looked like toxic sludge. Sometimes toxic sludge doesn't look like toxic sludge, but that river looked like something you would not want to swim in or drink.
Well, it did. And there were several things that the EPA then did is they were the ones, they never even contacted the owner of the mine to let him know that they were going to be working up there. They gained access to his property actually starting in 2011. And the owner of that mine, a gentleman by the name of Todd Hennis, had actually said that he didn't want the EPA working around that mine because he was afraid they would create an environmental catastrophe. So they brought an enforcement action against him, and they threatened him that if he did not give them access to the Gold King mine, they would fine him $37,500 a day. So he found himself in a circumstance where he had no choice but to do that, obviously. So over the years, the EPA monitored that mine. They knew that it had filled with water from neighboring mines and other decisions that had been made in terms of management in the area. And they went ahead and went in and dug out that portal. They weren't supposed to be working there that day. The EPA official who had made the decision to go in and try to take out that portal had been specifically told, because apparently he'd been talking about doing it for a while, but he'd been told by his supervisor that you are not allowed to go up there to the Gold King mine and do what it is that you want to do. We have to make sure that we have a plan in place, that we're able to contain any kind of fluids or water that may be in there and sludge. His supervisor went on vacation, and he apparently felt that that was the perfect opportunity to take on this little project. You can go to a website. All you need to do is Google the Gold King mine, and you can watch what they did. And there's a YouTube video that shows it. But what ultimately happened was when they breached that mine, that water came rushing down. It rushed down over the embankment, dumped immediately into the Animas River, made it all the way through to Lake Powell in Utah in very short order. And one of the things that was interesting is that with this, the nature of this catastrophe, it took hours and as much as 24 hours for the EPA to even notify people downstream that this wall of orange water or yellow water was headed their way. New Mexico has sued EPA. Several tribes that are down below have sued the EPA. The state of Utah has sued the EPA as well. And that case was recently settled, with the EPA agreeing to go into Utah and spend substantial amounts of money, in other words, our tax money, to do a variety of remediation programs in Utah. The lawsuit between New Mexico and the EPA continues, and then there are some other tangential cases associated with that. One of the things that was also very interesting in terms of what the EPA did was that shortly after that mine was breached, obviously they had to try to figure out what to do with the water that continues to drain out of that mine. And what they did is, again, without even notifying or asking permission of the landowner that was down below, the person who owned this called the Gladstone property. It was the historical town of Gladstone. It's above the town of Silverton. But what they did is they went in and built a $2.3 million water treatment facility on Mr. Hennis's land without ever even notifying him that they were going to do that. So not only did they breach his mind without letting him know and created that catastrophe, they then went in and took his property and took ownership over a concrete pad. It was on a very large concrete pad on his property, built this water treatment facility, and they have operated it there for almost 6 years now.
But the good news is, I'm sure they must have paid him for all of this, right?
Well, the EPA is an interesting agency, I guess you'd say, and the answer to that is no. In fact, the EPA has refused to pay him one thin dime for the entirety of that almost 6 year period. So they came in, took his property, he went to them, and they immediately said they wanted to enter into a lease agreement with him to pay him nothing. And he said, I'm not going to do that. You have to pay me. You've taken my property. You need to pay me for this. Their response was to again threaten him that if he did not leave them alone, essentially, and allow them to maintain and operate their water treatment facility at that location, that they would fine him again $37,500 per day. So coerced him into doing what he has since done, which is basically had to sit back and take nothing from the EPA during this intervening period of time. Finally, last year, he was fed up with them because they won't negotiate in good faith. They won't pay for the past use of his property. And so again said they demanded that he enter into a 20-year contract, I believe they were asking for. And he said, no, he wouldn't do that. That actually they weren't even asking for a contract, that he would just agree that he would allow them to stay there for that period of time. He said no, and they instituted an enforcement action against him in January of this year. And this time they threatened him with fines of $59,000 per day. So they went forward with an enforcement action against him, threatened him that if he does anything to try to prevent them from operating their water treatment facility at that location, he now will be subject to fines of almost $60,000 per day. So again, the EPA has an interesting approach to these things. I have encountered this exact same thing in the past. I was handling a case several years ago where they threatened the gentleman who in Wyoming who had straightened and cleaned out an irrigation ditch. And they concluded that that irrigation ditch was a navigable water of the United States. And they brought an enforcement action against him. And again, at that time, they were seeking penalties of $37,500 per day. They eventually took him to trial. And shortly before we went to trial, that penalties had accumulated to $65 million. The EPA had the opportunity or were potentially going to seek a penalty against my client of $65 million.
That's absurd. It
is absurd. And all he did was he straightened and cleaned an irrigation ditch on his own private property, affected 2.1 acres of land. But I think what this shows, Mark, and the point of all of this is it demonstrates the authority that these kinds of agencies have and why they're able to cause the destruction that they do and wreak such havoc upon individuals and business owners in the country.
The EPA must have at least fired the individual who breached the mine and caused these millions of dollars of damage and loss to taxpayers and loss of a river that used to be in good shape.
Well, that's the interesting thing, Mark. If this were an individual who had done this, if this was the landowner or the mine owner who had done it, he would have gone to prison.
Yeah.
He not only would have lost everything that he had, they would have taken every piece of property he had. They would have taken anything of value that he had. He would have been fined millions and millions of dollars for this kind of a catastrophe. But he also would have gone to prison. The person who did this was not fired. And to my knowledge, was never even reprimanded. There's never been any public indication whatsoever that he was held accountable for the decisions that he made. And keep in mind, it was not only the EPA that day, but it was the State Division of Reclamation, Mining, and Safety. We had two agencies out there. We had both the federal agency and the state agency, both of whom are responsible for protecting the environment. And they did such really mind-boggling things when they went into that mine. First of all, they knew it was that it had filled with water, yet they made no effort to determine how much water was in there, which was completely contrary to their standard operating procedure. So again, just more examples of abusive agency action, and we're going to have to fight against.
And lack of accountability. Thanks, Harry. Great story to share with our audience. Well, as Harriet mentioned in our last segment here on Administrative Static, we have a couple of different items from the Western United States today. And the second item that I wanted to address is one that we have talked about on this show before. And that's the case that the New Civil Liberties Alliance is bringing against the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives over the bump stock ban. For those who have been following this this saga, and it really is a saga, you know that the case began in the District of Utah. It went up to the 10th Circuit, a three-judge panel of the 10th Circuit, which upheld the bump stock ban. Then last September, NCLA was able to get a majority of the 10th Circuit to agree to rehear the case en banc, meaning all the judges of the 10th Circuit heard the case in Denver. Then, surprisingly, earlier this year, they dismissed that after oral argument in the case, after hearing all the arguments, they dismissed that en banc grant over the dissent of five of the judges of the 10th Circuit, including the chief judge of the 10th Circuit, all of whom wrote or joined opinions complaining about that decision. And the 10th Circuit reinstituted the panel decision. So that put NCLA in the position of either having to go back to trial in the district court with this adverse judgment from the 10th Circuit or appealing to the United States Supreme Court. And so we have decided to file a cert petition with the United States Supreme Court and ask them to hear this case. And as often happens when cases make it up to the Supreme Court and the issues get distilled, not everything that was at issue in the case in the beginning is still what's at issue in the case. So, for example, one of the main issues in this case, eventually, and one of the main problems with what the ATF did is that it misinterpreted the statute, right? Well, first of all, it assumed that it had statutory authority that it does not have to pass this kind of a ban, but then it misread the statute in order to do that. But that statutory interpretation issue isn't squarely in front of the court, or won't be as part of this cert petition. Rather, there are a couple of kind of subordinate questions that that the Supreme Court needs to help the parties sort out before further progress can be made in this case. And the first one of these has to do with something called Chevron deference, which we've talked about before. Chevron was a 1984 Supreme Court case that said that that agencies, if a statute is ambiguous and the agency has interpreted it, then federal courts are supposed to defer to the agency's reasonable interpretation of that ambiguous statute. That gives agencies a lot of power, and it takes power away from the courts. And it's not a good rule, and it's one of the precedents that the NCLA is the most interested in doing away with long term. But the particular way that Chevron came into play in this case is quite notable, because the U.S. government in court, in the district court, in the Tenth Circuit, at the en banc Tenth Circuit, disclaimed reliance on Chevron deference every step of the way. And they kind of needed to do that, because the agency admitted that they don't have the power to issue what's called a legislative rule. A legislative rule is one that essentially makes law, that does something new that hasn't been the law before. And that's, of course, what this bump stock ban was. It was making new law. But they don't have the power to do that under the statute. So they wanted to pretend that what they were doing wasn't a legislative rule. And because it wasn't a legislative rule, or because they said it wasn't a legislative rule, and it was just interpreting what the statute meant all along, according to the ATF, then they couldn't get Chevron deference for what the statute has meant all along. So they disclaimed Chevron deference. And like I say, they kind of had to, given their theory of the case. But notwithstanding that, we felt like we needed to argue against the application of Chevron deference in case the agency changed their mind on appeal, or in case the courts might think that this was a case that was appropriate for Chevron deference. And so we brought up Chevron just sort of long enough to tell the court that it doesn't apply in this case, and it shouldn't apply. Well, the panel at the Tenth Circuit said that because we had invoked Chevron in order to say that it shouldn't apply, we had invited the court to apply Chevron. Well, that's
They do that even over the objection again of the ATF itself? The ATF said, no, you don't need to do that. And the panel's like, oh no, because the defense said that Chevron didn't apply, we get to find that it applies.
That's right. We, the Tenth Circuit Court, are going to bend over backwards to defer to the will of the agency, even when the agency is asking us not to bend over backwards and defer to the will of the agency. It just shows you how out of whack Chevron has made the federal courts. I mean, the job of the federal courts is to say what the law is. That's what Chief Justice Marshall said way back in Marbury versus Madison. And and the courts have gotten so far away from their responsibility to interpret the law and say what the law is, and they've gotten so far into the habit of just deferring to what agencies say the law is, that I'm not sure they can see the shore from where their boat has gotten to. You know, they're just so far at sea with this reliance on Chevron.
And Mark, one of the things that it does is it allows the courts to completely abdicate their responsibility for interpreting the law. And so in a case like this, it can allow a political decision, if you will, to stand, even regardless of what the statute itself may say or what the agency had previously said.
That's right. And so the first question presented in this case to the court is going to be whether or not courts should defer under Chevron to an agency interpretation of federal law when the government itself has disavowed that deference. So that's one question that's going to be in front of the court. And, you know, that's it's definitely a question worthy of the court to address, because even though the Tenth Circuit said said that the agency can't waive Chevron deference, they're not the first Court of Appeals to look at this question, and other courts of appeals have said, well, sure, the agency can waive deference and forfeit deference and all sorts of things. And in some previous cases, the U.S. Supreme Court has at least implicitly suggested that agencies can waive or forfeit a Chevron deference. So there's a what we call a split in the circuits on this question, which is usually a good indication of something that is going to get the court's attention. Only the Supreme Court can really resolve that difference. And you don't want cases to come out differently in one part of the country than in another part of the country just because of what the circuit precedent is on something like that. So that's the kind of case the Supreme Court likes to take up and resolve in Washington, D.C. and make sure that the rule of law is the same throughout the United States for whether or not agencies can waive their reliance on Chevron deference. So that's one of the issues in the case. The second issue in the case is whether or not the Chevron framework applies to statutes with criminal law applications. So this may be an obvious point, but a ban on bump stocks is a criminal law, right? So even though Mr. Apotian, the NCLA's client in this case, hasn't broken the law, although sort of on the theory of the case that the DOJ has, that ATF has, he kind of has broken the law because they say that this has been prohibited all along. But when he purchased his bump stock, he got a certificate from the ATF saying this was a legal item and so forth. So, I mean, he was perfectly legal, everything he was doing all along. This was not some sort of black market or even gray market item that he was, contraband or something that he had. This was a legally purchased item that he legally owned and then had to turn over to the ATF for safekeeping for the duration of this lawsuit. But typically Chevron deference doesn't apply when you're talking about the criminal law, because the Supreme Court has said multiple times that it's the job of the courts to determine what criminal law means, not the job of the Attorney General or the Department of Justice or any federal agencies. However, there's this case from the 1990s called Babbitt, back when Arizona Governor Bruce Babbitt had become the Secretary of the Interior, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And there was a case, Babbitt v. Sweet Home, in which there was a footnote in that case that's become sort of famous in appellate advocacy circles, where the court suggested that if an agency had gone through sort of full-fledged notice and comment rulemaking, that the fact that there might be criminal applications for a rule wouldn't prevent the courts from deferring to an administrative agency's interpretation of the statute in civil context. But the problem with that sort of drive-by footnote is what Justice Scalia later called it. The problem with that footnote or with that approach is that the law has to mean the same thing in the civil context and the criminal context, because it's the exact same statutory language. You're just talking about what the penalty is. So even though Mr. Apotian isn't subject to any criminal penalties under the statute, because he's suing at a point in time before the statute is being applied to him, the next person who comes along, if the agency finds that someone is in possession of an illegal bump stock, they're going to be subject to up to 10 years in prison. It's very much a criminal penalty. Ownership of an unregistered machine gun or a machine gun manufactured after May of 1986 is a felony. And so the criminal applications here are, I mean, the statute is almost entirely about criminal applications. It's only this very narrow circumstance in which Mr. Apotian has brought up the case that makes it not criminal. But it's a criminal statute, and Chevron is not supposed to apply to criminal cases. And again, several other circuits have said that Chevron doesn't apply to criminal law applications. But the Tenth Circuit, in this case, thought otherwise. And the D.C. Circuit, in the other bump stock case, thought otherwise. So you have this additional circuit split on the question of whether or not Chevron applies at all to criminal law applications. And then there's a sort of third question, which is, if a court determines that a statute with criminal law applications is ambiguous and that Chevron does apply, then how does the rule of lenity play in here? Because the rule of lenity typically requires a court to construe a statute in favor of the criminal defendant if it's ambiguous, but Chevron cuts the other way. So which of those rules comes into play, or which one of those ideas takes precedence is the other issue here. And all of these things are cert-worthy, and all of them need to get resolved by the Supreme Court in this case. So hopefully they'll take the case and grant cert.